Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The American people need to understand the scope of this. We are going to borrow an additional $1.5 trillion just to fund the government over the next 2 quarters, 6 months. We're going to have to borrow the money. This is not a sustainable trajectory.
New Speaker of the House from Louisiana, Mike Johnson.
And so what's happening is the effect on the American people has been really devastating. You have a record high inflation. It's causing real pain for hardworking American families. It's leaving their futures uncertain. Families are having to make very tough, life-altering decisions because the cost of living is too high. Meanwhile, the skyrocketing interest rates are quickly turning the American dream into a mirage for millions of Americans. We feel that acutely here. And that's why House Republicans will not stop until we get this job done. We're on pace now to have 8 of our 12 appropriations bills passed by flyout tomorrow, as you heard. And we'll be right back here over the next 2 weeks to finish the job.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The Emergency Relief Program, this is essentially the third iteration of this program.
John Burge is Acting Deputy Administrator for Farm Programs at USDA's Farm Service Agency.
We had a program called Emergency Relief Program 1, ERP 1, which was for losses back in 2020. And then we had a second program called ERP 2 for losses in 2021. This one is for losses incurred in year 2022. And we just announced this on October 27th. It's a $3 billion program. Now, I want your listeners to keep in mind that that $3 billion is short. We knew it was going to be short. We had about $10 billion in losses. We had about $3 billion that we were allocated to put into this program. And the design here is to help offset financial impacts of yield losses and value losses, revenue losses, from qualifying disaster events. Now, those could be anything from wildfire to flooding to hurricanes to derechos. We had a tremendous amount of loss in 2022, just as we've seen thus far here in 2023. Those weather challenges are now, I think, in the third year in a row. Depending on where you're at in the country, it could be more like the fourth or fifth year in a row. But this was an opportunity for us to get some additional resources into people's hands so that they could offset some of those losses. We built upon some of the successes that we had in the first couple of iterations of the Emergency Relief Program. We are using pre-filled applications for Track 1. Pre-filled applications work very well in ERP 1. These are applications that are mailed direct to the producer. Producer essentially certifies what is on those pre-filled applications. These are based on losses that were covered by crop insurance or our disaster non-insured assistance program, commonly known as NAP, at USDA. Now, I want to clarify with that, people don't have to wait for those pre-filled applications in their mailbox. They can go into their county office if they think that they've incurred a loss that would qualify, and we could pull up that application in the office. The pre-filled application being mailed is sort of a backstop to that. In addition to that, we're running two different tracks, and the tracks are running concurrently. So you can apply for both, and you can apply for both at the same time. The second track is designed, this is a revenue-based model, and it's designed to deal with some of those issues related to what are called shallow losses. We had that some of that feedback from producers very early on in the process in the last ERP program. And the ERP factor on that track two increases up to 90% for insured crops. And that is to help address that non-indemnified loss or shallow loss not covered by crop insurance, which we also think is a good addition to that. Now, both of those tracks are going to be implemented at the same time. Producers may be eligible for both, and they're able to apply for both at the same time.
More information online, farmers.gov. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
This is an amendment that will take the wild horse and burro program back to the 2019 levels, or about $80.5 million.
Representative Morgan Griffith from Virginia, a Republican, during debate on the Interior Department spending bill.
In just four years, this program has gone up 46%. Now, I've always had some questions about this program anyway, because what we do, Mr. Chairman, is we rent land or lease land, the Bureau of Land Management has, but federal lands to farmers who bring their cattle in, perfectly fine, fully supportive of that. But because the wild horses reproduce at such a fast rate, the horses were eating up the grass before the cattle could get to it. So we decided we'd come up with this program back in the 1970s, and the original idea was that the program would have these wild horses captured and adopted. And there are some adopted. And in fact, we do some birth control measures. And in fact, Mr. Chairman, historically less than 1% has been used for birth control, but this year we're hoping maybe it goes up a little bit higher. That being said, a 46% rise in the cost of this program seems to be awfully high. And what do we do with all those horses that we don't get adopted or that don't get the proper birth control shot, usually from a helicopter? Well, we take them and we ship them to farms and we house them for the rest of their lives. So basically what we've set up is a very expensive retirement home for wild horses and wild burros. And we're on the hook. Now, you know, I know people love the wild stallions and it makes people reminiscent of the Old West. But I would remind them that the horse as it exists today is non-native to North America, was introduced as the Spanish first came in and then other European settlers arrived on the two continents, the North and South America. And I have to question, with the debt that this country has and the severe needs we have in other parts of this nation, on the border, around the world, why we're increasing spending on retirement homes for wild burros and horses about 46% over 4 years. So it just takes the program back. It does not eliminate it. Takes it back to the 2019 levels and starts to put an end to it. And Mr. Chairman, I know you're already aware of this, but at $2 a horse in long-term care, $2 a horse per night, there's a lot of other things we could do with that money.
Interior Appropriations Chairman Representative Mike Simpson from Idaho, also a Republican.
I rise in opposition to this amendment to decrease funding for the Bureau of Land Management's Wild Horse and Burro Program. I understand the gentleman's frustration. Many of us have been addressing this for a number of years, trying to find the right solution. We haven't found it yet. It used to be that they used to take these horses and slaughter them. Guess what? You can't do that anymore. The public won't accept it. And frankly, neither will I. In the West, continuing the wild horse and burro program at sustained levels is vital to controlling the population. Even with the funding provided, BLM will not be able to manage and curb the potentially exponentially increasing number in the herds. Failing to manage wild herds in the West would have devastating effects on rangelands and all of the animals that depend on them. Therefore, I must oppose the gentleman's amendment, and living in the West, I've seen this problem and what it does to rangelands. So if there's a better solution rather than just cutting funding, let's hear what that better solution is, because believe me, this committee has been working hard to try to find what to do about it, because we don't want to see these populations grow either. But it's a reality that they are, that we have to deal with. That's why it's got increased funding in this bill.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
No one has ever seen anything like what we have experienced here in Washington in the last few weeks.
Ethan Lane is Vice President, Government Affairs, National Cattlemen's Beef Association in Washington, D.C.
And, you know, we're big here on drawing parallels to past events and, you know, trying to find, the last instance of the situation like this. And you know, weeks ago, we were at a point where we could hearken back to, you know, nothing since the end of the Civil War, right, in Congress reflects what we're seeing currently. We're far beyond that at this point as far as, unprecedented territory. You know, the divisions we've talked about for some time in the Republican Party, the discussions of the, you know, quote, five families in the Republican conference spanning from the Freedom Caucus on one end to the problem solvers and the moderates on the other end, you know, was on full display in the last few weeks as we watched them go through a variety of candidates that couldn't quite get the conference to coalesce. So it was really gratifying to see them finally settle on Mike Johnson here at the beginning of the week and do so in a unified manner. It was an unexpected result, but after the last few weeks, boy, it was nice to see.
So now that budget and deficit is the top issue, how do you navigate?
You know, this is that age-old conversation about how, you know, how do you eat an elephant, right? You one bite at a time is kind of the best system anyone's come up with so far. You know, in years where, you know, we don't hear about that, and certainly we went all through the Trump administration, and this isn't a knock on the Trump administration or the former president, but it's a reality. There was very little talk about the deficit while we were adding to it, right, for many years. And then you can almost predict that, you know, when Democrats come back into power, you know, that's going to become a talking point again. But the fact remains, we have an unsustainable amount of debt. And typically, the easiest way for political points to be scored in that conversation is to look for ways to cut discretionary spending. You know, those are the programs that are the easiest to give a haircut to. But the problem is, you can eliminate all of the discretionary spending in the federal government and still not curb the upward trajectory of the national debt. And that is, I think, at the root of what Chairman Arrington, and I've had those conversations with Chairman Arrington, new Speaker Johnson, I've had those conversations with him in the past as well. I think that's sort of what they're trying to achieve here, is a more sober conversation about mandatory spending, about some of those programs that don't necessarily enter the conversation in a comprehensive enough way. And we're talking about entitlement programs. We're talking about kind of the third rail of politics in Social Security and Medicare spending. And what we do about those obligations, and they are obligations because Americans, and myself and yourself included, pay into them every time we receive a paycheck or, you know, we make a quarterly tax payment. And what we do about those programs and the, you know, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of Americans that rely on them. There is not a Republican in the country, that doesn't have to at least consider that when making changes, lest they have a bunch of very angry constituents that want to know why their check just got cut in half. I think that's the aim there is, okay, can we have a conversation about how to shore up those systems for the long haul in a way that starts to send that debt in the other direction? And it's probably, it's the appropriate conversation to have, but boy, it's a politically difficult one.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The sort of resounding theme here is if there's questions about the emergency relief program, all they've got to do is go in and talk to those county staff in their local county office, and they can walk them through how to get into the program, whether they have any questions about what might be on their pre-filled application, and that sort of thing.
USDA's Farm Service Agency rolling out ERP 2022. This is the Emergency Relief Program. John Burge is Acting Deputy Administrator for Farm Programs at FSA.
I will mention also, Tony, that there's been some discussion about this, that because we're about a third of what we need in terms of the losses out there, we've got to do our very best to spread that those resources to producers across the board. And one of our efforts here was to apply a factor, and a factor is, in essence, to try to spread those resources while getting resources into everyone's hands. We did this a little bit differently this year. We focused on what we're describing as a progressive factor. And the progressive factor is designed to sort of give a higher factor to lower payments up to a certain amount. So for the first $2,000 of a payment, you would get 100%, and then it would go down proportionally thereafter. An important thing to remember about that is that 82% of our producers. We're anticipating that this is going to provide assistance to about 206,000. So 82%, or roughly 170,000 people, are going to receive a better payment under this progressive factoring plan than they would under a flat factor. And that's important because we're able to get more resources into some of those smaller operations proportionally than they might have had otherwise. So we think that that is a good enhancement as well. So I don't know if that helps, but that's kind of the quick summary. I'm glad to answer any additional questions that you've got, but we're very excited to finally get this out. It's been a long time coming, and a lot of people have been clamoring for it. And it just took a little while to design, but here we are. And people are coming in droves. We get reports every day, and I anticipate that we'll be seeing a lot more people as the fall turns into winter.
So FSA is sending out some pre-filled applications, but will there be an application deadline?
So as of right now, there is no application deadline, and I don't anticipate that there will be for some time. In terms of needing an appointment, no. I think that folks can go in. Part of the hope here was in getting this announced early, even prior to the pre-filled applications going out, was to ensure that people knew that they could just come into the office, meet with their local county staff, and have a discussion with them so that they could pull up their records and see what information was there. That has been how we've had all these folks get signed up thus far. I mean, the program's really only been open for about a day and a half. And as of this morning, I think we've had 3,000 applications filed, and we've already got payments in the system to be paid out. So it moves pretty quickly if you get into the office. If you'd like to wait and have the paper in your hand to go in and ask questions about, that's perfectly acceptable as well. Those pre-filled applications are going to start hitting people's mailboxes next week.
This is Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Today I rise in support of my amendment, which prohibits the BLM from finalizing its draft Rock Springs Resource Management Plan, the purpose of which is to severely restrict livestock grazing, mining, energy development, recreation, and other activities on 3.6 million acres of land in southwestern Wyoming.
Wyoming Representative Harriet Hagerman, as part of the 2024 Interior Department Appropriations Debate.
The BLM is required to update its resource management plans approximately every 10 years. The Rock Springs Field Office began the process of updating its own plan in 2011 in accordance with FLIPMA. The proposed RMP contains four alternatives for the planning area. Contrary to the very purpose of the BLM, it has chosen the most restrictive, the most draconian, and the least scientifically defensible plan, the one that Wyomingites are the most opposed to, as its preference that being alternative B.
Claiming opposition, New Mexico Representative Teresa Fernandez.
Last Congress, Democrats made historic investments in rural America's infrastructure, the most investments since the New Deal and the Rural Electrification Program. In contrast, the Extreme Interior Bill, Republicans would roll back all that progress. We can't face the climate crisis on a 1991 EPA budget, which is what this bill would do. 1991? Really? We know our parks need the care that they deserve. They are America's promise, and we are ignoring them and letting them deteriorate.
Fernandez and Hagerman debating an amendment to the Interior Department and EPA spending bill.
Thank you. None of the response from my colleague on the other side had anything to do with the amendment before us, so I'm just simply going to proceed with the statistics related to this particular RMP. The RMP severely restricts vehicle access, including 4,500 miles of routes to all uses, while removing an additional 10,000 miles of routes from the transportation network. This draft RMP designates 1.8 million acres out of 3.6 million acres as areas of critical environmental concern without any congressional input whatsoever. Perhaps what's most disheartening and disturbing and illegal about this RMP is the fact that it's ignored not only stakeholder input over the past 12 years, but the input and analysis undertaken and completed by the BLM personnel in the Rock Springs District's office. The administration has proven time and again that its primary agenda is to push forward with the radical Green New Deal, as we just heard from my colleague on the other side, and that it views the opinions of unelected bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. over the citizens of this country, and that it does not care whether its actions actually work on the, in the real world or cause severe damage. In addition to the fact that Alternative B is just plain bad on its face, it was also adopted in violation of FLTMA and NEPA. According to a former BLM engineer who worked in the Rock Springs field office on this very RMP, most of the research and work went into studying and pursuing Alternative D. What does that mean? The most controversial alternative, the alternative that the BLM is now seeking to impose on Wyoming, was never adequately evaluated. Alternative C, which includes heavy recreational restrictions, also had little time and little review. The lack of planning and analysis and input related to Alternative B exposes the fact that this is a political decision that is not based on the real-life situation in the Rock Springs District, but more related to the idea of blocking any access to our natural resources for the things that we have historically used them for.
House debate comes just one day after the Senate voted to pass three of its fiscal 24 appropriations bills in a minibus, including the one for Interior. Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You know, I've really been amazed in the last 15 years the progress that we have made in reproductive efficiency across our industry.
Dr. Mike Brook is a dairy specialist at Kansas State.
One of the key things that really helped us gain improvement on our reproductive programs, I think, is the application of something that we call pregnancy rate. We break the herd down into 21-day periods, and we divide the number of pregnancies by the number of animals that were eligible for breeding during that same 21-day period. As we focus more closely on something other than conception rate, we are actually able to move our efficiency numbers forward in leaps and bounds. So we use lots of different techniques to get cows to come into heat, and we use lots of different techniques to detect whether or not they're in heat and make sure that we are inseminating at the proper time. And all of those have been part of increasing our reproductive efficiency on our dairy. So as I look at numbers today compared to, say, 15 years ago, you know, 15 years ago, preg rates on a lot of our dairies were barely 20. And today, as we look at numbers coming in from those herds that are doing an excellent job, we're actually seeing herds that are either approaching 40 or exceeding 40 on preg rate. Now, there's probably some tricks to making sure that you have a higher number rather than a lower number. And one of the things that I often visit with producers about is when we're determining pregnancy rates, it's really important that we understand what the voluntary waiting period is on our dairy. And we get into that discussion, that's the number of days we wait until we would actually inseminate an animal. Well, when we get into that discussion, there's a lot of variation across our dairies as to when would we actually put semen into an animal. You know, for some dairies, it's by 60 days in milk or maybe by 70 days in milk, particularly if they're on some sort of reproductive management program. However, there may be a few animals that we put semen into a little bit earlier because they show us a good strong heat. And we will take a chance that we will go ahead and do a breeding there, particularly if we've noticed a heat in a previous cycle on that animal. So what number do you use for your volunteer waiting period? Because that's going to really impact the size of the breeding herd. What I encourage our farms to do, if you are doing a little bit of cherry picking and breeding a few animals early, I wouldn't necessarily put in that earliest date that we might put semen into a cow. I would put in the date that we generally target to put semen into a cow. Now, if we generally start moving that date back on a higher percentage of our animals, probably need to make an adjustment there just to be fair to make sure that we're accurately portraying what's going on in terms of the size of the breeding herd. Other than that, it's really a matter of just making sure that we get semen into cows the first service on the date that we intended to. And then secondly, that we do pregnancy determination as soon as possible, so those animals that are still open can be re-enrolled into some sort of program to make sure that we get a second service into those animals as quickly as possible. Really, these two things are the things that probably drive our success in increasing the pregnancy rate on our dairies. And as we move forward, it's important that we continue to focus on these things, as getting these animals pregnant on time is really important to when they will calve in the next time and the length of our overall lactations.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Brazil's biggest producing state for soybeans is Mato Grosso. Of course, down there, it's planting time, and producers are running into a little problem.
A lot of the fields have dried up, and they need more rain.
USDA meteorologist Mark Busberg says that's slowing planting down as of the end of this past week.
Mato Grosso had planted 70% of their soybeans.
Not bad, but the five-year average is 72%. Last year at this time, they had 83% planted. Not a huge problem for the beans, but
anytime a soybean field gets planted late, that means the second corn crop following that gets planted late. And, you know, so late planting doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be a problem with the soybeans, but that sort of raises our concern for the second corn crop,
which, of course, competes with U.S. corn. Gary Crawford, Washington.